It's Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022, and I call this meeting of the House Higher Education Committee to order. The CLA will take the roll.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill. Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright. Present. Representative Daniels is excused. Representative Erickson is excused. Representative Hansen.
Hansen present.
Hansen present. Representative Heintzman. Representative Heintzman. Representative Howard.
Howard present.
Howard present. Representative Keeler.
Keeler present.
Keeler present. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne present.
Cleborne present. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick present.
Kosnick present. Representative Creshaw. Representative Creshaw. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason present. Representative Mecklund.
Mecklund present.
Mecklund present. Representative Noor.
Noor present.
Noor present. Representative Sandell. Representative Sandell. Representative Sandsted.
Present.
Sandsted present. Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill present. Sorry, I had some technical difficulties.
No worries. O'Neill present. Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Creshaw, I see, just joined. Representative Sandell. Representative Thompson. Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you very much. And next, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 16th, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleborne moves approval of the minutes for March 16th, 2022. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 16th, 2022 are approved. Next on agenda, or first on agenda, I should say, we have House File 3888 from Representative Morrison. We have 20 minutes scheduled for this bill, and we will plan to wrap up at 3:30. I will move that House File 3888 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 3888. Welcome to the committee, Representative Morrison. Please present your bill and to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I'm grateful for the opportunity to present House File 3888 on World Water Day. It's a bill to appropriate money to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota for the Water Council to develop a plan to ensure that Minnesota has enough clean water for the next 50 years. It specifically calls for an assessment of the current state of Minnesota's waters, both surface and groundwater, throughout all geographic regions of the state, identification of any gaps in data or information with respect to the quality and quantity of Minnesota's waters, and recommendations for obtaining any necessary data and information, and to identify opportunities for Minnesota to act proactively to ensure that Minnesota has an adequate supply of clean water for the next 50 years. The bill is driven by the reality of accelerating climate change and increasing water scarcity. Climate change is making droughts more frequent, severe, and pervasive. By some reports, over half of the global population could be facing water scarcity by the year 2025. Minnesota is home to some of the world's premier freshwater resources. Our identity as a state is directly tied to clean water. We are, after all, the land of 10,000 lakes, or the land of sky blue waters. Between the Mississippi River, Lake Superior, and the Boundary Waters, Minnesota is home to three of the most recognizable and important bodies of freshwater on Earth. Over 10% of the world's freshwater is found in Lake Superior. We're uniquely blessed with an abundance of freshwater. but we cannot take for granted that we will always have enough clean water. Our nearby fellow Great Lakes state of Michigan provides a cautionary tale of the consequences of not having a proactive water policy. And the reality is that Minnesota's water is under threat. 56% of Minnesota's waters are impaired, according to MPCA. EPA lists an additional 30 as impaired. Climate change contributed to a record drought in Minnesota last year. Lead, PFAS, and other chemicals, agricultural runoff, and other threats put Minnesota's water at further ongoing risk. Other states have already attempted to buy or export Minnesota's water. The truth is that Minnesota will likely become a destination for climate refugees, both from within the United States and internationally. We must act now to best prepare for the future so that we will have an adequate supply of clean water. Our unique geography requires that we be excellent and careful stewards of our water. And given that Minnesota is home to three significant watersheds with life-altering consequences for downstream communities, we have an additional responsibility to be planful stewards of our water. Let's start by creating a science-informed plan to do so. Our future literally depends upon it. Thank you for your consideration of this bill, Madam Chair and members. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Now we'll go to member questions. Does anyone have any questions? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, I'm just kind of looking at what you're working on here. And the question I have is the general fund source for the dollars. And I'm wondering if this is something that is a completely new idea and it just wasn't able to get submitted to the Clean Water Council for some kind of recommendation, or if there may be yet time. I'm looking and I see that we just saw, as of I think 2 days ago, the Clean Water Council met and found that they have, if I'm remembering correctly, a $54 million in extra unexpected money that's yet unappropriated, which 5% of that goes into a reserve fund. So if you do the math, I'm figuring it looks like $47 million available. Is that something that could potentially work towards getting this done? I'm seeing there is a companion in the Senate side, but I'm trying to figure out if maybe the funding mechanism could be adjusted and we could get some support from the governor's office maybe and from others that would be affected by this.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Heintzman, for bringing that to my attention. I am very open to a different funding source to getting this bill done. So I will investigate. Thank you for the idea.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman, and we also have, just so you know, Mr. Hopkins' hand up, just in case you want to refer to him now. But you go ahead, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was the other half of my question I was hoping to also get answered, and that was, is this a new idea, or is this something that hasn't been on the radar? I'm not sure where Representative Morrison's bill might have come from. I think I've heard of this suggestion in the past, but I don't know that we've discussed it here in this committee.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Heintzman. I can't speak to the history of bill introductions about this topic, but it is a passion of mine and it's a concern of many going forward in Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, it'd be great to find out kind of where this is coming from and what the history is on this language, and if the bill author could maybe come back to that at some point with my office, that would be helpful. I'm sure that the discussion is going to wind up in the Environment Committee or on the House floor at some point. It'd be good to have that background. Does Mr. Hopkins have something that he wanted to add? Otherwise, I have a few more questions.
Okay, I didn't hear the end of your statement, but we'll go to Mr. Hopkins. You're on mute, Representative Albright.
Were we going to go to Mr. Hopkins or not?
Oh, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, I cannot hear Mr. Hopkins.
Yeah, I can't either. Okay.
Madam Chair, he had his hand up. I don't know if he intended
to do that.
I just thought I would put a questions.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins.
Sorry about that. My microphone wasn't working. Madam Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins from House Research. I just wanted to offer as a point of clarification, there is a water council that is part of the University of Minnesota that is not, it's different than the Clean Water Council that's established under Chapter 114D. So this is not the Clean Water Council under Chapter 114D. This is a part of the University of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
There might have been a misunderstanding. I'm not sure if maybe Mr. Hopkins thought I was referring to the University of Minnesota Water Council. I was definitely not. I was referring specifically to the Clean Water Council. If those watching the committee today are unfamiliar, I'll just mention 3/8 of 1% of our sales tax drops into what is constitutionally known as a legacy. And then that is divided in 33% increments. Part of it, 33% of almost $1 billion goes towards water-related projects, and recommendations are generated through the Clean Water Council. And like I said to the bill author, Representative Morrison, that may be something, and the language in this bill may be something that has been considered there, but I don't think we've got any history on that today in the presentation, so that's why I asked the question. I think I'll just make a comment and then let some other folks ask questions. But when Minnesotans voted for the Legacy Amendment and when they established the what is run by the LCCMR, the Environment Natural Resource Trust Fund, the expectation was that these kinds of things would then have funding. But it seems as though when a number of committees have been hearing proposals like this, they almost always go right back to the general fund. And I don't know why that is, because clearly the intent of Minnesotans when they supported the Environment Natural Resource Trust Fund and the Legacy Amendment, which of course spends a huge amount of money in this subject area, $256 million in the biennium, that's obviously something that is significant and a appropriate funding mechanism that the voters supported. So if we could maybe figure out why this didn't make it through that process, if it had previously been proposed, which it doesn't sound like, I said, doesn't sound like the bill author knows that or not, but it would be great to have some more information. I'm gonna be a no vote on this today, even though I think that there may be some merit to the bill, simply because I'm concerned that we're not following the process that Minnesotans have supported for this kind of environmental work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, Representative, I'm looking at the objectives that are laid out in the bill, and it certainly appears like any one of the agencies that we already have in existence, whether it be MPCA, DNR, the Met Council, for that matter, or as Representative Heintzman illuminated, the Legacy Amendment really does capture, you know, the impetus for a lot that is in your bill. And so my first question of two is, if this organization or this council is housed at the University of Minnesota, first, where do they receive their funding? And if it is through the University of Minnesota, why wasn't it included in the U of M budget?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. I'm proposing this study now to be done through the U. I'm not sure I completely understand your question.
Representative Albright. Okay,
so Madam Chair, so this is an initiative of a brand new council. If I understand what your initiative is.
Did you have a question? Did you want to have a question, Representative Bobbitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Much like Representative Heintzman, I'm trying to understand if this is a new appropriation through the general fund for the Minnesota for the Water Council that's held or overseen by the Board of Regents at U of M. Is this an existing council or is this a brand new council?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. The Water Council is an existing council at the University of Minnesota, separate from the Clean Water Council that Representative Heintzman was referencing.
Madam Chair, then my follow-on question reverts back to what I said earlier in terms of if this is funded through the University of Minnesota, why did it not, why wasn't it included in the U of M's budget request? Why are we seeking funding for it now? And if it's a new allocation appropriation, any number of one of these, in particular the legacy, would already fulfill those obligations. Clean water. So I'm like Representative Heintzman, I'm a little lost for the why and wherefore for this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have questions and concerns very much like my two previous colleagues. And I'm really kind of taken aback that somebody from the University of Minnesota Water Council isn't here, because I want to know things like, well, how big is your total budget? And is $650,000 half of your total budget? All kinds of things like that. These are questions that we need to know to put things in perspective. Also, if you're going to lay this over, then it doesn't have an opportunity to be heard in the Environment Committee, which is the experts in that issue area. Yes, we are higher ed and we understand higher ed funding, but this is, there is hundreds of millions of dollars that comes through the legacy amendment that Minnesotans voted on. And so we have issue area experts. We just happen to have Representative Heintzman on our committee. And I am really thankful for him that he's here, but he alone cannot vet a bill. It should be before the Environment Committee. We're going to be looking at this. And again, I'm really shocked that somebody from the University of Minnesota is not here to speak to this, because I have a whole lot of questions that I'm sure the author cannot answer. Like, how long has the Water Council been a part of the University of Minnesota? What is your total budget? What is the percentage of this ask compared to your total budget? What other things have you done on the Water Council? Why do we have a Water Council outside of the Clean Water Council? It's very confusing. I don't know if they started, you know, hundreds of years ago or if they started 2 years ago. This is, there are so many questions I have, and I don't think they're here to answer any. And Madam Chair, I have a question for you. If you would let me know if this bill is going to be heard in the Environment Committee so it can be properly vetted for its content, not just its funding.
Representative O'Neill, not at this point.
May I speak?
Yeah, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's problematic. There's so many unanswered questions. So I would just leave it at that we have a whole plethora of questions, no one to answer them. And really the heart of this discussion should really be in the Environment Committee, where they can properly discuss that. They are all the experts on the Clean Water Council, the legacy money, where this probably should be funded. So Madam Chair, I would ask that I know you're going to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, but quite frankly, there are just too many unanswered questions that we can, you know, if it goes in the omnibus bill, I can ask it again there and I can ask it on the floor, but this isn't ready, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Morrison, since you don't serve on the Ag Committee, I'll start off with a little bit of an opening statement. This year, I asked in the Ag Committee for a plan, an aquaculture plan for our state. And the reason I'm saying that is because every representative can bring forward a request of an entity to do a plan that provides for an interest of the representative's
community. Now, I know that in your particular community, water is a huge issue. Is there anything that you would want us to know about that as we're thinking about this bill?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleburne. Certainly, water is a big issue in my community. It's dominated by Lake Minnetonka, which is one of the most used and loved lakes in the state. But water is fundamental to all of us. And so this is not unique to my district. This impacts every single one of us in our state. This is an emergent issue that we need to tackle. The Water Council was chosen at the suggestion of scientists at the university because it has expertise in multiple areas of science, including agriculture and climate change, and is probably best positioned to create an apolitical based plan. So I would just reiterate that water is life. We all need water and we all need clean water, and our water is in danger.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Morrison, for that question. And the reason I asked it is because we don't really have to have the approval of the University of Minnesota for us to bring forward a bill that would be research done by the University of Minnesota. I have brought forward bills that the university has not asked me to do, and they are not always present to defend the bills that I bring forward. They're my initiatives. And so I just want to say thank you for your commitment to clean water. It drives our economy in so many ways in Minnesota. And I hope as they're looking at this, they'll be looking at the groundwater as well as they're doing this 50-year plan. So thank you very much, and I appreciate the bill.
Okay, we have Representative Heintzman has his hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We, I think, still have extra time on the clock, and I thought since we happen to have a few more minutes, I would ask an additional question, if that's okay.
Yes, fine. Representative Heintzman, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cleburne brought up an interesting point, and it kind of led me to another thought, and that was maybe Representative Morrison, as she had been describing the council at the University of Minnesota relative to water, could Representative Morrison maybe go through some things that group has done that may benefit the state, as Representative Cleburne was suggesting that it has? I'm not necessarily connected to that, maybe, you know, in the way that I could have otherwise. So if Representative Morrison could go through maybe some accomplishments that we'd be familiar with, and that could help the committee.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Heintzman. It's Representative Cleburne. But, you know, I am not expert in all of the work that the Water Council has done, but scientists at the university are very, you know, they're expert in their field, and I have a lot of faith in our University of Minnesota, and it was recommended to me that this would be the appropriate entity to perform this study.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, I would love to have the same confidence that you do without any actual facts, but I would love to have a better idea if there is anything that this organization has been a part of that was noteworthy. That would be certainly a benefit to us making an appropriation like this available to them. And also a plan as to, you know, what is going to be done with the dollars and so on and so forth. If it isn't successful in the current process being simply laid over without allowing the Environment Committee to vet it and have some opportunity to speak to it, maybe in another generation of this, you know, I would suggest moving through the process and maybe giving more people an opportunity to weigh in. And if those questions could be addressed, I think that certainly could give it some opportunity to be successful. Otherwise, I'm a little concerned that it wouldn't be. especially with the funding mechanism in place from the general fund, as I mentioned earlier. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the additional time. And looks like we're coming up on it, but if there's more, I might have an additional question as well. Thank you.
Representative Cleavorn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Bernardi. And you know, I'm a huge advocate for the wonderful research that we do at the University of Minnesota. And just kind of as a quick response to what does the Water Council do? Anybody can Google water.umn.edu and see the really terrific work that the Water Council does there, from concern about the sediment that is in our watersheds, buying water for the environment, stormwater challenges, promising polymers, wild rice, cultural collaboration, and the list goes on and on. Our scientists at the University of Minnesota are often the hidden gems of our state. They do their work, they do it quietly, and the entire state benefits from their work. So I just want to make sure that in talking about this bill, we don't in any means denigrate the great work that the University of Minnesota does that serves our entire state. Thank you.
Okay, okay, I'll take one more question here. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just reiterate that having an opportunity to better understand what the council does or has done would be beneficial. And anybody can Google that. That's true. I was hoping maybe that the bill author might have been prepared for those questions today. So that was specifically what I was alluding to. And I certainly think that there may be an opportunity for all of us to better understand what the what this group does, but it really wasn't provided today, and they're not here to actually provide input themselves. So that's something that I think would have been helpful and wanted to go ahead and ask those questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that opportunity.
Okay, thank you. We will now go back to Representative Morrison. Would you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. We have a water crisis, and I hope you will join me in supporting this bill so that Minnesota can develop a comprehensive water plan so that we and our children and grandchildren will have adequate clean water. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Now I will turn the gavel over to Vice Chair, Christensen. Let's see if I can, oh, there you are, great.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Next on the agenda, we have House File 3892 from Chair Bernardi. We have 30 minutes scheduled for this bill, and we will plan to wrap up at 3:55. I will move that House File 3892 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 3892. Chair Bernardi has an author's amendment labeled A1. I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Chair Bernardi, can you tell us briefly what the amendment does?
Yes, Madam Chair. Members, this amendment is based on feedback from institutions who have already incorporated affirmative consent into their current sexual harassment and violence policy and makes some changes to make the affirmative consent standard more workable in real-world situations that college students find themselves in. This was based on advice from career staff who work with students to address these concerns. It adds language clarifying overt actions in exchange for verbal consent, and it clarifies the meaning of physically helplessness on line 2.4.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Bernardi, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This idea for this bill started with a constituent of mine who wanted to see the state of Minnesota have affirmative consent established in a law as required part of the sexual harassment and violence training required for all Minnesota college students, faculty, and staff. What my bill does is establish affirmative consent standard in law that would be required, a required part of the sexual harassment and violence policy bill that will require colleges and universities to have in Minnesota. Some people might know this as yes means yes training, and it refers to the idea that sexual consent should never be assumed by one party. Whoever initiates sexual interaction has a responsibility to ask for and receive a verbal yes, or for some, or some form of overt act that any reasonably sober person would consider to have the same meaning from your sexual partner before pursuing any level of sexual contact. I realized that there was no mention of affirmative consent in the consent training and advice being given to students. And I think it is important that we lay down a marker in law that the state supports the institution, the instruction of affirmative consent to show that we support the efforts already being made by our institutions to create a safe and healthy environment for our students to learn. I'm not opposed to incorporating education on the criminal definitions of consent. I talked with Representative O'Neill earlier. I believe that we should, we're gonna work together before before the end of session, and perhaps maybe in the Senate or our omnibus bill to get in tip-top shape. I know she has a lot of expertise in this area. And I also want to thank our members for the work they've done in the bill in the past to get it into the current shape that is in, to help our students understand what affirmative consent means, and for helping to advocate for safe climate on our college campuses. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. And I believe you have some people with you who'd like to testify.
Yes, I do. With me today is Ivana Stark, and she is a constituent of mine and an advocate on this issue.
Okay, Ms. Stark, please state your name and continue.
My name is Ivana Stark. Chair Christensen and members of the committee, if you Google what are the chances of being raped in college, you will get back that among an undergraduate students, 26.4% of females and 6.8% of males experience rape or sexual assault through physical force, violence, or incapacitation. In other words, over one quarter of young women can expect to suffer some sort of sexual violence while in college. In 2015, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education reported 236 sexual assaults on college campuses. This number does not reflect the unreported number of victims too frightened to come forward. As a mother of two boys, a school board member, community leader, and assault survivor, I cannot emphasize the importance of this bill enough. As a survivor of a violent assault, I think back to that night a lot. I remember the cold concrete under my head as the heavy pressure of my assaulter's weight, his hands tight, my hair, and every single thud my head took into the floor, and the fear trapped in my throat. I was afraid that if I cried out, I would be in trouble for what was happening. I immediately took the blame and shame because of that's what our culture has taught us to do. I must have asked for it. I shouldn't have worn that outfit. I shouldn't have had so much to drink. I should not have let myself be alone with him, that sort of thing. I'm 38 years old and my entire life has been full of messages telling my generation that we should expect it and that it just happens. And that once it's over, we should just move on. Such attacks shape people for the rest of their lives. It changes how a person exists, how they interact with others, how they maintain relationships, and how they parent. And the raw feeling you carry around with you never quite goes away. You never ever stop looking over your shoulder. Far too often, ignorance about the moment is used as a defense. Responses such as they wanted it, they didn't say no, or they started it seem to be on a constant loop of repetition. For many, this bill may result in the first time a person is empowered to say no. It may be the first time that a potential assaulter is educated on what consent means. This bill has potential to protect all of Minnesota's college students, and it truly has the potential to save lives. House File 3892 is a strong step in making systematic change towards protecting countless people from a moment that will haunt them for the rest of their lives. Requiring that all higher education institutions spend just a few moments articulating their code of conduct, explaining what affirmative consent is, and intolerance to any form of sexual assault is the right step for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stark, for advocating and for sharing your story. Thanks so much. I don't see any questions. Anyone have questions? Lead O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, are there more testifiers or are we to the member questions portion?
There are no more testifiers, Representative.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't sure. Thank you, Chair Bernardi, for bringing this bill. So I should say in full disclosure, I wrote the entire section of law that we're looking at, and it's much more expansive than this. In 2015, I did a massive overhaul of what happens in every single higher education institution regarding sexual assault and sexual violence. It's encompassing not only making sure that students understand the full breadth and depth of the entire section of criminal sexual conduct, understand the law, that there's actually a memorandum of understanding with every single institution with law enforcement so that there's an easy handoff, there's reporting requirements. So the bill that I passed in 2015 is literally nation leading. In fact, I'm just gonna give you a quick little anecdote just to tell you how nation leading. I was doing the freshman orientation the year that now Congresswoman Ilhan Omar was going through her freshman training here at the House of Representatives. And I was doing my portion with a few other people, including Representative Lesh, who I worked on revenge porn with and so on. And I was starting to talk a little bit about this bill and about working across the aisle and how you get things done. And it was quite interesting. And at the end of this section of freshman orientation, then Representative-elect Ilhan Omar came up to me and she said, oh, are you Representative O'Neill? I have to talk to you. I'm so excited to talk to you. I've heard all about you. And I looked at her and I said, well, I've heard all about you. And she said, no, I was just in DC. And we talked all about your bill, about these policies that we're discussing today, about criminal sexual conduct on college campuses. And so this statute is literally a national model. This statute has been vetted and discussed and very carefully crafted. I have never made so many amendments and so many adjustments to a piece of legislation in all of my time here. So what I would say is that if we take this step and move in this direction, we are undoing some very important things. And let me explain what I mean by that. When you look at specifically on line 2.32, we are literally removing the reference to the criminal statutes about what consent legally is. That is a really large step backwards. We want the students to know very, very clearly what does the law say about what is consent and what is not consent. Now, the verbiage above where it explains what consent is in great detail, that is sort of a combination of statute and case law and kind of what's understood. That's fine if you want to, you know, define all of that. I think that the institutions since 2015 have done a really good job at explaining what affirmative consent is. And I would reiterate the fact that affirmative consent is our state law. That is law. It's not anything new. The kind of description of what some of these things are not completely accurate. You know, we just changed what mentally incapacitated means. And so this language actually is a little bit antiquated because we updated mentally incapacitated quite a lot. That was all over the news. It was a Supreme Court's ruling and a case was actually upheld because the lack of clarity and the lack of what mentally incapacitated covered in our statutes. And so Representative Mueller and I and many, many others worked incredibly hard to change the definition of mentally incapacitated, as we did many aspects of our criminal sexual conduct statutes. So to take that reference as what the institutions are supposed to teach kids away from what the statutory definition is of consent is really going backwards. We don't want to do that. So I would strongly oppose doing that. Like I said, some of the language above of kind of defining what actually is affirmative consent is not terribly problematic. It's not very clean. It's not exactly what it is, but it's close. I think we can work offline on some of the nuances of this. Your amendment made it a little bit closer to what statute actually says, but this is again why we absolutely need to tie it to the criminal sexual conduct statutes and not something else. You have to tie it to criminal law. And the reasoning behind that is because when we change criminal sexual conduct statutes, this would tie directly to that. So it's updated automatically. We don't have to go back and redo it. So I don't want this language the way it is. It would undo things that we worked really hard in 2015 to establish. It would undo some things that we worked really, really hard across the aisle to do when it comes to some of the definitions of what mentally incapacitated is. The language just says it's close, but it's not exact. It's just not quite right. And you know, if you're going to teach college students about what consent is and what consent isn't, you should actually have it exactly what the law says so that they know. It's nice to have, you know, a deeper explanation, and that's fine. And that's part of the whole program that they have to go through. So they have to do it either online or in person. There was even a section of this law passed in 2015 that we did that allows anonymous reporting of sexual assault so that they can kind of know what to do, and it kind of alerts them. And there's all kinds of components of this. This is just one little small component, but I know that Chair Bernardi and I will work on this to see if really anything really needs to change. I'm pretty sure the institutions are pretty good at giving full explanation as to what affirmative consent is and what that legal definition is. Because really that's the key, is both parties need to know exactly what legal affirmative consent is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Chair Bernardi, anything?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. It's enjoy working with you across the aisle and working on this in our committee to make it just the way we need it for our students, and expanding the definition to include more education and communication for our students. What it means is really important in keeping our college safe. So I look forward to working with you in as we move this bill forward through the session. The goal here is to support the work institutions are already doing to help capture situations in which we have all witnessed. We could clearly say that one of the people in the physical interaction was unwilling. It's very important in the student context to establish the need for clear channels of communication for affirmative consent, and not just simply waiting for no. Through education on these issues, promotes healthy relationships and safer learning environments where thousands of students may be living and learning in close proximity. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Any other discussion? Rep. Cleburne. We can't hear you, Rep. Cleburne.
Sorry about that. I would just like to thank the testifier for coming today and sharing her very personal story with us and helping us understand the need that we always have to be mindful that until everyone feels safe, we have work to do. So thank you for sharing your story with us, and I want you to know you were heard today in committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Cleburne. And Chair Bernardi, any other comments you'd like to make?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this bill today. I do look forward to the bipartisan collaboration as we work on this bill. And I too want to thank Ivana Stark for coming today and for her advocacy and doing all she can to help keep students safe so no one has to experience what she has experienced. And she has been a great leader and advocate on this issue and as many other things in our community helping young people. So thank you.
Okay, so hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3892, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. I will pass the gavel to Chair Bernardi.
I'm getting the gavel. It's taking a bit of time to get here. It's kind of a ways. And I will now move us into the next part of our agenda here. We have House File 2578 from Representative Schultz. We have, let's see where we're at now with our minutes, around 30 minutes. My timer is not showing up. Well, we actually have a little bit more time than that, so that's awesome today. I will move that House File 2578 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 2578. Representative Schultz has an author's amendment labeled DE4. I will move the DE4 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Representative Schultz, can you tell us briefly what the amendment does?
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members. Really appreciate this hearing. This DE reforms how the legislature nominates, recruits, and appoints members of the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. Chair Bernardi, would you like me to go through the whole explanation, or can we adopt the DE and then I can proceed?
Yeah, before us, we have an amendment, and I will move that DE4 amendment to be put the bill in the form that the author wants. Representative Schultz, can you briefly tell us about the amendment?
Sure, Chair Bernardi. So I'm going to walk through the different sections. So the first section provides that the legislature shall elect a tenured faculty member and a representative of a university employee labor organization to two of the Board of Regents' three unassigned at-large seats. It also provides that one regent shall be a member of a recognized American Indian tribe in Minnesota. Section 2 amends existing law to address how redistricting and reapportionment of congressional districts shall affect the election of members to the board. So, for example, I hope this doesn't happen, but if we lose a congressional district or the lines change. Section 3 imposes a two-term limit on the regents on the board. Currently, they're six-year terms, and so it would impose a 12-year limit. The RCAC process for recruiting, vetting candidates, the membership is changing. So Section 4 changes consists, instead of 24 members, there'll be 25 members, of which 5 are appointed by the House, 5 appointed by the Senate. There'll be 5 current faculty members, 1 from each campus appointed by their respective faculty senate bodies, 5 student body presidents, 1 from each campus, and 5 designees from the listed councils in the bill. And that those councils are the Indian Affairs Council, the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and the Council on Disability. Section 5 eliminates an RCAC provision preventing it from indirectly imposing regent term limits, as actual term limits are now imposed in Section 3 of the amendment. Section 6 requires the Joint Legislative Committee for regent nomination to nominate 2 candidates rather than 1, for each vacancy on the board. It prohibits floor nominations at the Joint Legislative Convention for regent election and requires the Joint House and Senate rules to be amended to conform to this new section. And then finally, Section 7 requests the board to amend its policies to allow a tenured faculty member and or labor organization representative to serve as a regent, consistent with Section 1 of the DE amendment.
Thank you. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion,
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have before us House File 2578. Representative Schultz, please present your bill to the committee.
Yeah, that was the entire bill. That was the it was a delete everything amendment. So as many members know, I've been working on reforming how we go about vetting and appointing members of the Board of Regents. I always have wanted to make sure there's more diversity, that it reflects the faculty, students, and staff, the body at the university. And I also wanted to prevent nominations from the floor, since those nominations, sometimes the person's never even contacted to find out if they want to be on the Board of Regents and not vetted. So we're trying to improve the process. And I do have with me several testifiers today. So I'm ready to go to those testifiers if you are, Chair Bernardi.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Professor Jeff Ropp, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Ropp. Good afternoon, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota Duluth and the legislative liaison for the University Education Association in Duluth, or UEAD, the union which represents over 500 faculty at UMD. Today, I'm here to urge you to support the proposal to require the University of Minnesota Board of Regents to include one tenured faculty and one representative of a university employee organization. The importance of this legislation is obvious when you consider the current makeup of the Board of Regents, which includes individuals with titles like CEO, President, Executive Director, Higher Education Administrator, and those who work for corporate entities as attorneys and consultants. Individually, the experience that each of these backgrounds provides is valuable, and we are grateful to all of the regents who have dedicated their time to volunteer on behalf of the university. As a collective, however, the board lacks members with ground-level experience in the function of the university. Academia is famously a unique workplace that operates in different ways than other organizations. While many regents bring useful outsider perspectives to university issues, there is also an urgent need for insider knowledge. Indeed, the current structure of the board recognizes the importance of stakeholder input by reserving one at-large seat for a student. Yet while students are at the core of the university's mission, they have a limited view of how it operates. This is not a criticism, but a simple fact. A great deal of what faculty and staff do to keep the university running, from research to administration to maintenance and beyond, does not directly involve students. Simply put, the Board of Regents cannot knowledgeably direct and supervise President Gabel and her administration without having faculty and staff members who are intimately familiar with the university's mission and day-to-day operations. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. We now are going to move to Professor Scott Lederman. Please proceed with your testimony.
Chair Bernardi and members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to appear before you today. My name is Scott Lederman, and I am a professor of history at the University of Minnesota Duluth. I'm one of Jeff Ropp's colleagues. As I'm sure you know, UMD is the second largest campus in the University of Minnesota system and the second largest research university in the state. I'm also the immediate past president of the University Education Association Duluth, or UEAD, which Professor Ropp mentioned a moment ago. It's the union representing some 550 faculty at UMD. During the 2 years I served as president of the union, I attended the Board of Regents meetings on the Twin Cities campus. This included not just the official board meetings, but also most of the committee meetings where issues were initially introduced, discussed, and debated. I was nearly always the only faculty member in the room. The rare exceptions were moments when faculty were being recognized for their research or public service, or were reporting to the board on the activities of the Faculty Consultative Committee, a Twin Cities-based shared governance group from which faculty at two of the system's five campuses, including UMD, are excluded. Despite always being in the room during board and committee meetings, I was never part of the conversation. That is because only members of the board or those they invite to speak are allowed to participate. During my 2 years witnessing the board in action, it became abundantly clear to me just how greatly the board would benefit from faculty participation in those conversations. While the university is fortunate to be served by outstanding regents, it is nevertheless the case that none of its membership has a deep faculty background at the university and therefore understands how faculty think about various issues. Some of the regents are graduates of its five campuses, and some have children who are or were students. But the student experience, like the parent of a student experience, is of course quite dissimilar from the faculty experience. Students and parents have only a very partial view of what happens at the university. For better or for worse, faculty know and see the institution much more fully. We are the stewards and deliverers of its academic mission, and we tend to think with that academic mission top of mind. Faculty bring unique insights grounded in our role as instructors and as researchers, and these are insights from which the board would greatly benefit in its deliberations and decision-making. I know this for two reasons. First, because regents would occasionally seek me out between committee or board meetings to ask me what I thought about some particular issue. This was usually after the fact, however. And second, I know it because I and other members of the UEAD leadership periodically meet with several of the regents. They tell us how much they appreciate our perspectives, which are not ones they are necessarily accustomed to hearing. Having a faculty member on the board would change that dynamic, allowing a faculty perspective to be included in real time in official board deliberations. I thus hope the legislature will see fit to pass this important piece of legislation, allowing a broader, more inclusive, and more representative Board of Regents for our great University of Minnesota. With that, I again thank the committee for allowing me to testify, and I would welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Now with us, we have Gertrude Jo Hall. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Good afternoon, Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, Lead O'Neill, and members of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you for allowing me to be here and testify before you. My name is Gertrude Jo Hall. I am a fourth year undergraduate student on the U of M Twin Cities campus, and I currently serve as the chair of the student representatives to the Board of Regents. In my role over this past year, I have had the opportunity to work closely with the regents in a professional capacity. During this time, I have learned of the many nuances and challenges that come with working with the highest board of governance at our university. However, one of the biggest challenges I have faced has been getting the board to truly listen to the many burdens students have been facing, especially throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. In December of this past year, an important issue arose where the university president was receiving a large pay increase. And the question I posed to the board at the time was as follows: if there are monetary resources available to further compensate the president, where are the monetary resources for students facing immense financial barriers? Students have been tirelessly advocating for a wage increase for over half a decade, and yet the board failed to advocate for financial accessibility at a time when students needed it most. Rather than addressing the concerns I put forth, the board immediately moved on and raised the president's pay regardless of the thousands of students who signed on to a letter calling on the board to prioritize student needs through equitable student pay. The board not only neglected to listen to the needs of students in this crucial moment, but they have disregarded and overlooked numerous student demands around student wages, tuition hikes, the most recent of which took place over this past summer, reckoning with institutional history, and other important issues. Actionless words and empty promises have become the norm. It has been normalized for students to be neglected, even as the cost of living and inflation has been on the rise. Student wellness has been negatively impacted by the pandemic, and tuition rates have increased. This is why it is vitally important for the university to have regents that listen and prioritize student needs and concerns. And House File 2578 is an important step in the right direction. By prioritizing student representation and representation from diverse communities on the Regent Candidate Advisory Council, it would ensure that those being recommended to fill each vacancy understand and recognize the needs of a diverse student population. This would provide greater transparency throughout the Regent selection process and ensure that the most important stakeholder at our university, which is students, have an equal opportunity to provide their input and expertise. Moreover, student seats on the board are essential. Those elected at the time they are students have a unique perspective of how certain issues affect students. For example, in April of 2019, former Regent Abdul Omari, who held the student seat at the time, was the only regent to vote in favor of renaming Twin Cities campus buildings named after racist and anti-Semitic individuals from the university's past. He listened to the concerns of students in a thoughtful manner and was the only regent to put those concerns into immediate action. Increasing the representation of those who at the time of election are students further solidified the board and the university's commitment to prioritizing students. Lastly, prioritizing the election of an individual from an Indigenous community would be an important step in ensuring the university fulfills its mission as a land-grant institution. Students deserve transparency and prioritization. University leaders must be held accountable for their actions or lack thereof. Students no longer wish to plead or listen to promises that bring no real change or positive outcomes. Reforming the Regents election process is a vital step towards emphasizing student priorities and needs. Thank you so much, Chair Bernardi, and thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you very much. Members, is there any discussion on House File 2578? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I wanted to just say hello again to Ms. Jo Hall. I was in the room when she was allowed an opportunity to speak to the Regents, and she had an incredibly powerful message to deliver. And I would agree wholeheartedly with her that it fell on deaf ears because there was no change in the Regents' vote. They had decided how they were going to vote, and they voted how they were going to vote. And that was directly related to the president's pay raise, which I have talked about at great length. I've also talked about the 1.5% tuition increase in the middle of a pandemic, which she also referenced. All these things are very difficult for the student population, things I have been saying this entire time since we've come back into session. Also, the Regent Boards decided to cut 3 men's sports programs and 40 positions for women's sports, 40 individual positions, it was done without input. So I understand the frustration with the Regent Board. I have incredible frustration with the Regent Board. I hear your concerns. I was in the room when you shared your concerns. I hear the concerns of the faculty. I believe too that many times the concerns of the faculty are not taken into consideration. Because again, in that December meeting, in the room were many faculty members and coaches, specifically from those sports teams, that were cut without even an opportunity to address the board. They were given zero opportunity. I think the public needs to know that the Regent Board takes no public input as far as there's no portion of the Regent meeting where the public can just come and testify. You have to be invited and approved in order to speak. And on that particular day, the only one that was allowed to speak was the very articulate student that just spoke to us just now. Even though there were many faculty in the room, there were many staff members, there were union members in the room, all opposing the raise of the president. That being said, this bill to me is incredibly problematic. And the pieces of it that are incredibly problematic are completely changing the RCAC board so that the legislature has so little power, because the only power that we have in the legislature is the purse, which I've been talking about at great length, because the University of Minnesota came with nearly $1 billion ask. And if you add in the tails, it was a full $1 billion ask in a non-budget year. In any case, so we have the power of the purse and we have the power of appointing regents. And I would note that this last round of regents that we had a Native American candidate that came forward, Mr. Alkire. And he was very close to being put on the Regent Board, but James Farnsworth was the one that prevailed. And James Farnsworth, although he's not a member of a tribe, he has 20% of his heritage is actually Native American, but he's not, I'm not sure how you say that exactly, but he hasn't filed to be a member of a specific tribe. But in any case, he's got a very diverse background, but he prevailed, and the Native American candidate that was very good, a lawyer, a very articulate, Elk Hire, did not. So I know that we're moving in that direction, but my concern about this bill is that it cuts and it guts the power of the legislature. We have so little power now with the region, with the University of Minnesota, because they predate statehood, you know, they have autonomy. And so the last vestige of influence that the legislature has is the Board of Regents. And if we put together an RCAC group with only 10 of the 25 members appointed by the legislature, that undermines our ability. And then if you take away our ability to nominate somebody from the floor, which, by the way, James Farnsworth was nominated from the floor. I'm the one that nominated him, and he got 101 votes from the body. That eliminates that ability. And yes, he was contacted ahead of time. And yes, he went through the whole RCAC process and everything. I've never even heard of somebody being nominated. I've been here 10 years. I've never heard of anybody being nominated from the floor that had not been contacted in advance and had desperately wanted to be a regent, who, by the way, are not paid either. That's all voluntary. So there's better parts of this bill than there's just really bad parts of this bill. I mean, we, the legislature, have to have some sort of authority over the University of Minnesota. And if we got the process that we use to put regents in power, you've taken a huge part of our power and authority away, and there needs to be checks and balances. So, I don't have an issue. I'd like to see the RCAC board just go away altogether. And that was your original bill. And then you did the DE and instead changed it from a board of 24 to a board of 25. But then you only maintain 10 of the 25 to be members of the legislature. Well, appointed by the legislature doesn't mean that they are members of the legislature. But the RCAC board has historically had issues, and I fully agree with that. I also agree that the current regent board does not listen to faculty. I was in the room when that was happening. Maybe we need a regent member that's a faculty member. I don't know, but I definitely think the regent board needs to listen more to the students and to the faculty, because they've been a little bit tone deaf, I think. The last thing that we want is just the regents to not be the check and balance to the administration. That's what they're there for. They are the governing body to not just rubber stamp whatever the administration wants to do, to actually vet it and move it forward. And I think in that process of administration just deciding stuff, I think students and faculty have been left out of that equation. I agree wholeheartedly with that part of what you're saying. And I don't know exactly what the answer is, but I think that this is not the answer. This is undermining the authority and power of the legislature, which we are already so limited in our ability to weigh in on anything at the University of Minnesota. So that's what I have to say. If we were voting on this bill, I would vote absolutely no. This is not the direction we need to go. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Member, are there any other further questions? Seeing none, I will go back to Representative Schultz and ask if she has any closing remarks.
I do. I'm first just really appreciate those comments, Representative O'Neill. I have brought stronger bills forward, and they just didn't have as much support. So this is my latest effort. I'm really happy. Our staff are busy, and so this amendment was finalized later. We were still tweaking it right before the deadline. So I haven't had time to sit down with you, Representative O'Neill, but would be happy to. I think the legislative body still has a lot of control. So the joint committee can, after candidates go through the RCAC process, you can nominate others that the RCAC may not have named, as long as you have a lot of committee members who support those nominations. So even with the change and bringing, you know, more people on and from different groups to the RCAC board, I still think the legislative body has a lot of power and control. But let's talk. I'm glad you like other pieces of it. And so I'm optimistic that we can maybe work on this and get something through. and maybe you can help me with the Senate as well. But I really appreciate those comments and that feedback. And I know this bill will be laid over, so I think we have some time to work on it. So I hope that you are receptive to that.
Okay. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2578, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Well, I want to thank all of our testifiers today and our members and those that are tuning in today. With that, our meeting is adjourned.